Okay, so hi everyone. A really warm welcome to Sangha Night. So this evening we're going to be talking about the theme of harmony. So we've been looking at this overall theme for a few weeks now called the head, heart and guts. Head, heart and guts. And total transformation is its sort of subtitle. And so it reminds us that in the Dharma life, we need to look at transforming all the different bits of ourselves. We can't just focus on one little bit of ourselves. We need to kind of bring all of ourselves along on the path. So firstly, we need to transform our minds, our wisdom. So we need to correct our distorted vision of the way things are. So we need to replace our kind of old, out-of-date views about things with new, up-to-date and more correct views about things that cause us much less suffering and other people less suffering. We also need to work on our heart and our emotions. So we need to become loving and expansive people who can actually hold and carry out the vision that we see with our new eyes of understanding. And finally, we need to transform our volition, our will as well. We need to work on that too, because without will and motivation, we can't really do much about any of the other things in our lives. So we need, our Dharma life includes all those three aspects. So, and associated with each one of these areas is a different figure, a different bodhisattva that we call the different family protectors. So there's three different ones we're going to reference in this little series. And we started off by looking at Manjushri, who's the golden lord of wisdom holding the flaming sword, cutting off wrong views associated with wisdom. So we spent some weeks looking at him. And then last week, Suryamati introduced us to the theme, the section around positive emotion. And the associated figure with that is called Avalokiteshvara. So we've got this beautiful tanka of Avalokiteshvara here, in case you've not seen it before. So just to recap a little bit about Avalokiteshvara, which we heard from Suryamati. So if you want to go into more detail about him, I'd recommend you listen to her talk from last week, which was excellent. But I'll just say a little bit for anybody who wasn't here last week. So his lord, this is the name written down here, and it literally means the Lord who looks down. So he sees what is truly needed in the world. So he's the bodhisattva of compassion, the bodhisattva that responds to the cries of the world. And he's a beautiful, over there, he's a beautiful bodhisattva. He's made of white light and in the prime of youth. And you'll notice that he looks slightly odd. He's got this kind of white halo, which is actually made up of arms, 1,000 arms. So he has various different forms, Avalokiteshvara. And sometimes we see him with 4 arms or 8 arms. But sometimes we see him with 1,000 arms, as he's depicted here. So a very important pair of arms are the ones right in the centre. And the arms in the centre hold what's called the Chintamani. The Chintamani, which is the wish-fulfilling jewel. And for a Buddhist, the wish-fulfilling jewel means the will to enlightenment. So the will that we should alleviate the suffering of all beings by attaining enlightenment for their sake and for our sake. So for everyone's sake. And we can sometimes call this, sometimes you'll hear this called the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment. And that's symbolised by this wish-fulfilling jewel that's held to the heart of Avalokiteshvara. And then in all the other arms, very interesting, they've all got eyes. So all the arms, the hand, the eyes in the hands are helping him to see what's really needed in the world so that he can respond. And they're also holding things which are helpful, different things that can help in different ways, the different hands. So that's a little bit about Avalokiteshvara. So last week we also heard how Avalokiteshvara is also a symbol which has been taken for this community. So Sangharakshita, who set up this movement and order, he once said that we could think of our movement, our Sangha, as being like Avalokiteshvara, all being different hands of Avalokiteshvara, in order to work in harmony for the benefit of all beings. So what I thought I'd do this week is tell you about another community who works just like that, so behaves as if they are different hands of Avalokiteshvara, all working in harmony for the benefit of all beings. So, and by looking at this community, I thought maybe we could see a little bit more about what harmony might really be, really true harmony might be, and how they achieve it, and how we might be able to achieve it in our community as well. So we're going to look at a story that comes from this sutta here, called the Chulagasinga Sutta. And it's about these characters called the Aniruddhas. So there are 3 Aniruddhas. There's Aniruddha, Kimbala, and Nandiya. But they often have just one spokesperson, which is Anna Rudder. So they become called the Anna Rudders. So I'm just going to call them the Anna Rudders. So the Anna Rudders are living at the time of the Buddha, and they're living in a secluded park. And the Buddha comes to see them, comes to visit them. So he comes in, and the first thing that happens then is that the Anna Rudders, they prepare a seat for him, they wash his feet, they get ready for the Buddha, they show him lots of reverence and respect because he's their dear teacher. And then the very first thing that the Buddha says is he asks them how they're doing, if they're getting enough food, if they're well and comfortable, and they say, yes, we are. So that's and then the very next thing that he says after that is, and are you living in harmony? The very first question that he asks. And I thought this is very interesting. It's the very first thing that he asks. He doesn't say, so how's your meditation practice? Are you getting on well? Is it every day? Are you getting into dhyana? He doesn't ask that. He doesn't say, so have you all got insight? Are you all enlightened now? Very good. He doesn't start with that. He starts with, are you living in harmony? Are you living in harmony? So very, very important. But he doesn't just say, so are you living in harmony? He gives some beautiful images which give expression to what harmony might actually be at its fullest, most full-blooded sense. So this is what he says. I hope, Anuruddha, that you are all living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. So living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. There's a really beautiful evocation of harmony and what harmony can be. So let's start with mutual appreciation. So are you living with a mutual appreciation? So he doesn't say, are you putting up with each other okay? It's not about harmony, it's not about putting up with each other. It's not just, so harmony isn't just an absence of disagreement. It's much more than an absence of obvious disagreement. He's asking whether the members of this community are appreciating each other, whether they're relishing each other, whether they're rejoicing in each other, whether they're really admiring of each other. So that's what harmony for the Buddha consists of. That's included in harmony. He also asks if they're blended like milk and water. So I don't know if you've ever drank milk and water or blended milk and water. Maybe when we make tea, we put the milk in the water, don't we? And it would be very unusual if the milk and the water didn't blend. It's a lovely natural image. And when I think of milk and water together, I imagine the clouds of milk sort of spreading naturally and sort of smoothly through the rest of the water, giving colour to the rest of the water. There's no question in that image that the milk and the water are going to be separate and things that would attack each other. They're very, very, it's a natural, soft image without any conflict in it. So it's an image of a total absence of any conflict. And then he asks, are they viewing each other with kindly eyes? Pia chaku, the eyes, dear eyes, literally dear eyes. So eyes, the eyes that we have for somebody that we love, the eyes that we have for somebody that we care about. And you know, if we really love and care about somebody, well, we just see how beautiful they are, don't we? We see all their lovely, endearing features, and we tend to overlook their annoying characteristics. We just see what's beautiful about them. So that's what he's asking. He's asking, are you looking at each other with those eyes? Are you looking at each other with eyes which see the best in each other? That's what harmony would involve. So that sounds lovely, doesn't it, if we were to live like that? Well, that would be lovely. But it also sounds quite full on, like it's a very kind of intense and very big vision of what harmony could be. So it might sound like a bit of a tall order to have that in a community. But it's not impossible, because Anuruddha says, well, yes, that's exactly how we're living, just like that, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes and with mutual appreciation. And all the others, all three of them, they all say that. They all agree that's how they're living. So it's quite interesting. So how do they live like that? And the Buddha's interested in this question too, because then he says, so Anuruddha, how do you live thus? He wants to know as well. So then, this is what Anuruddha says. Venerable sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards these venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind, I think. So what he does there is he gives the Buddha a list of the practices that their community do in order to keep their harmony. So the first thing to note about that is that it's a practice. So harmony is not just a thing that magically descends upon a community without any work or effort. It's something that is created and cultivated between the members of that community actively, doesn't just happen automatically. So what are these practices? Because it might be good we could learn something from them if they're living in this amazing way. Maybe we could do some of these things as well. So this is a little list of what they say. Okay, so the first thing they said they do is they reflect on the benefits they've received. They reflect, it is a gain. It's a great gain for me that I live with this person. How lucky am I? So that's how they start off. They cultivate gratitude. They cultivate gratitude for the person that they're thinking about, for the other people in their community. And in Buddhism, gratitude is seen as a very, very important emotion. But it's not necessarily a feeling. Very different, very important to differentiate out emotions and feelings. It's not necessarily something we automatically feel. And the word that's often translated for gratitude is katanyata. That's the original word in the Pali or Sanskrit. And it means literally an acknowledgement or an awareness of the benefits you've received from another person. So it's not necessarily how you feel about them, but it's understanding that they've benefited you. And it's so easy, isn't it, to look for what's annoying in people and to see their faults and what you don't like about them. Very, very easy. We've been trained as a society to find what we don't like and to blame people. No, they're not doing what they should be doing. They're not doing what we like. They're not doing it the way we would be doing it, because obviously that would be better, the way we were doing it. So some of us might be more disposed to think like that than others. I certainly am. Some of you might be a bit less critical. But if we're at all critical, we might think like that. And we've probably all experienced this in the Metta Bhavana, because obviously the Metta Bhavana, we're not supposed to be doing that, but we often do, don't we? Especially if we get to the difficult person stage and we bring that person to mind and we're annoyed. We're annoyed we don't like them. So we think, oh, they're so annoying. They did that thing that I really don't like. And then that makes us think of another thing we don't like about them. And before we know it, we've just been thinking about all the ways we find them annoying for, and then we hear the bell for the next stage. And that's the whole of that stage. I don't know if, is that just me? So that's not the Metta Bhavana that we're doing there, is it? That's definitely not cultivating the eyes of friendliness and love. That is probably the irritation bhavana or the annoying bhavana. So, yeah, not the best way to go about viewing each other with kindly eyes. But that, you know, it's so easy to do, isn't it? So easy to do. So instead of doing that, what we can do is we can practice thinking of things that we really, really like about that person and the ways that we've benefited from it. So I've been living in a women's community now with other women for about 7 or 8 years. And so I've lived with lots of women in that time, and it's probably no surprise to learn that in that time I have at times been irritated with people that I live with, because that's part of communal living. And I remember a particular time that somebody who I lived with had done something to annoy me. And it got so that every time I saw this person, I thought of that thing that annoyed me about them. And it was like that was all I could think about, that they became that thing that had annoyed me. It's like all of my response to that person became about how they were annoying to me. And I had no room in my being for any other response other than just annoyance. And I became very irritable and intolerant around them. And I quite quickly realised this was a bit of a major problem here, because you can't live with somebody and that not become a problem. So I decided to attack this in the manner of the Aniruddhas. So I sat down in the shrine room to do a metta-bhavana, and I decided I was going to reflect on all the ways it was a great gain for me that I was living with this woman. And interestingly, immediately, all my irritation started to drop away because I wasn't saying, is it a great gain for me? I was thinking, it must be a great gain for me, so how is it a gain? And I immediately started to think of things that were beneficial. So this person also has lots of very, very lovely, lovely qualities that I did benefit from, generosity and kindness and a sense of fun, all those things I benefited from. I also benefited from the fact that we didn't always agree, because that really helped me to understand that I don't know everything and to challenge my strongly held views and to help me go deeper and to develop empathy and understanding for people who have a different approach to me. And I even benefited from the fact I was annoyed with her because it was helping me to work on my ill will. So I benefited greatly from this woman. And as soon as I started to reflect on that in that way, I immediately started to feel much more warm and loving towards her. And our relationship changed instantly. Like, instantly, the next time I saw her, it was completely different. So it was very, very powerful practice. I wish I'd done it sooner, to be honest. So I'd recommend that as a practice. If you're feeling annoyed or out of harmony with a person, you can just devote some time to really reflecting on how you benefit from them. And there's bound to be at least one way that we benefit from somebody who annoys us, even if it's only that they're giving us a good opportunity to work on our ill will and to have somebody in the fourth stage of our metta-bhavana, which is a great gift, great gift. And actually, once we get past the initial resistance of actually wanting to like this person, because we can have a lot of resistance to even opening our hearts to somebody in the first place, once we get past that, we might discover, actually, we gain from them a great, great deal. Okay, so then the second thing is they practice acts of metta. Acts of metta in body, speech, and mind. So they do say and think things that are metaful, both openly and privately, so in these six ways. So what does openly and privately mean? So I think that open acts are ones that people see and observe, and private ones are things that they don't necessarily. So I was thinking that an open act of metta might be, for example, on a Sangha night, if you are seeing somebody in the tea room, making them a cup of tea, or going to talk to somebody who looks a bit miserable, or, you know, offering to take somebody's cushion back for them at the end. These are like open acts of metta and friendliness that we do for each other, responding to the person who's standing or sitting in front of you. So the beneficiary is sort of aware of those actions. I was thinking of a private act of metta would be sort of a secret act of metta. So thinking, so for example, some people like to stay behind at the end of classes and empty the dishwasher, which is a very heroic thing to do. And that's secret because hardly anyone sees it. Or people who go around tidying up at the end of a class or taking mats and cushions of a person who's gone. Things like that, so or putting money in the dana bowl without, you know, making an announcement. So these things are benefiting people, but that we're not sort of shouting about them. We're just doing them secretly. And I was reflecting that I think this second sort of metaphor act, although it's sort of harder because you're not getting anyone patting you on the back, actually I found quite a lot more transformative than the first one. And something, an act like this I try and do, is when I'm left alone in a room, I try and leave the room tidier than it was when I came into it. I particularly try and do that at home in the community. And I don't always manage it, but I do think it's a really good practice because it makes me bring to mind the people who aren't me, the other people who will be using this room. So I have to use an active imagination. And what that means is that I start to get into the habit of routinely thinking of the effect that I'm going to have on other people and wanting to make things nice for them. So it really helped to undermine this habit of selfishness, which I had when I started to live into the community. I didn't necessarily automatically think about the effect I was having on anyone at all. But now I think I do, and I think it's mainly from practices like this where I make a practice of trying to bring people to mind when I'm doing things like that, when they're not there. And it becomes more automatic. So saying metaphor things. So saying metaphor things openly. So what would this include? It might include things like saying loving and appreciative and kind things to a friend. to expressing our gratitude and appreciation for somebody to their very face, which sometimes we're a bit squeamish about, but it's a really lovely thing to do because people do actually sort of blossom under that kind of kindly appreciative speech, a bit like a flower opening out. We can even rejoice in their merits to them, so we can give them a big long list of all the reasons that we love them and things we think they're great about them. And we can also pass on, if we've heard somebody else say something lovely about them, we can tell tales on them. We can say, I heard somebody saying how great you are at this. It's like the opposite of gossip. It's the best thing because somebody will hear a lovely thing that somebody else has heard about them, like rejoicing in merits. And so that's how we can do it in open. And in private, I was thinking speaking in private, we might be able to think about how we talk about that person in our minds. And we could look at that. So we might want to rejoice in that person's merit in our minds. So about our speech, our internal speech about that person. And I was thinking another way of acts of meta, speaking acts of meta privately, would be to rejoice in somebody's merits behind their back. So tell somebody else something lovely about them. So that's one of my favourite ones. I love telling, rejoicing in people's merits about telling somebody. This is complicated, isn't it? Saying something to somebody about somebody else that's lovely and wonderful. And this sort of harmonising speech, I think, really helps to create harmony and bring people together in the community, because it helps people to see the best in each other. And when they do that, they naturally want to come together and they want to relate into the highest in each other. So I think that's a really lovely thing to do. And then finally, thinking metaphor things. So, yeah, it's important to note and clock, really, that thinking is an act, and perhaps the most important act that we're going to do, because how we behave and speak will kind of spring from how we're thinking. So how we act is a really how we think is a really important act. So we need to work directly on our minds and to promote harmony with others. So one of the ways we can do this, I've already talked about, is reflecting on the ways that people are great internally. We can also really make sure that we're doing the metta bhavana, because that is a really tried and tested practice for cultivating metta and harmony for other people and viewing them with kindly eyes. It's especially important if we don't want to do it. Like, it's really important to do it if we're feeling annoyed and we don't want to be in harmony with somebody, because that's the cure for that illness that we've got there right in our fingertips. And so we can do the metta bhavana. And both on and off the cushion, we can be really clear with ourselves that we're not going to indulge thoughts of ill will. So we might not be able to instantly love somebody that we really don't like. That might be really hard and far into the future. But we can at least be really clear with ourselves that we're not going to deepen our habits of internally moaning to ourselves about that person and nursing thoughts of hatred and ill will. We can be clear with ourselves that we're not going to do that. So even if we can't love them, we'll at least not deepen our hatred. So that's acts of metta. And the third one is exchanging self for other. So he considers, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind, I think. So he considers, why is what I want to do more important than what they want to do, actually? And why don't I just do that? Well, I will, then that's what I'll do. So that's how he goes about life in the community. It just sounds so lovely, doesn't it? It's so lovely. And his friends say they also do the same thing. So they're all letting go of what they would prefer to do, and they're all just doing what somebody else would like to do. So there's this lovely kind of slightly mysterious coincidence of wills where nobody is sort of pushing their way onto any of their friends. And it's really important to say at this point that this isn't some sort of weird martyrdom, self-sacrifice thing that they're just like, oh, I can't possibly do anything that I want to do because that's very un-Buddhist. I need to just never enjoy myself. It's nothing like that. It's coming from insight. It's coming from insight. And it has to do with a point that Suryamati made last week that was originally made by an 8th century monk called Shantideva. And in summary, what Shantideva says in his text, the Bodhicharyavatara, is he says, so basically, if you've got your hand and your foot, if your foot is hurting, you don't think, oh, well, I can't help my foot because my hand is different from my foot. Your hand would help your foot because they're part of the same body. It wouldn't make any sense to not help your foot with your hand because they're attached to the same body. And so your hand and foot will both benefit at the same time. So he says, just like that, it makes no sense at all for one person to be suffering and not to help another person. Because actually we're the same. There's no actual essential difference between us in the fact that we're all interconnected. So we've been hearing this since week one of the introductory course, that seeing reality more clearly involves seeing how we're interconnected. If I cause suffering for another person, it can't not cause suffering for me. That is just how things are. If I make another person happy, that will just make me happy. That's just how things are. So he sees that. He sees they all see that. They have that insight into the nature of reality. And seeing that, it makes absolutely no sense to force their will onto their friends and make their friends miserable. Of course, they're going to want to do what their friends want to do. And we might not have had this experience in a big community, but we probably had this experience with at least one person that's very dear to us. When we see them and, maybe something amazing has happened to them or they're having a really bad time, and we just want what's best for them. And we couldn't really say that what was best for them and what's best for us in that moment is different. Because, of course, what I really long for them to be happy. They really long for them to be happy, so I want them to do what makes them happy. You can't really separate out my will from their will in those moments when we're really, really connected with that other person. So that's what he's talking about there. So we can call this exchanging self for other. Exchanging self for other, this practice of letting considering how we and other people aren't really different, how we're intimately connected. So I was reflecting that it's interesting that this is even necessary. So these are we hear later on in the sutta, they're very highly attained individuals, these Aniruddhas. So he talks about how he needs to let go of his preference and do what the others wish to do. So there's a difference. They don't automatically want to do the same thing, actually. They don't necessarily agree all the time. If they did all agree, there'd be no need for them to put aside what they wish to do and do what the other one wishes to do, because they'd all wish to do the same all the time. So there must be difference between them. So I thought that was really interesting. And I was listening to a talk that Sangharakshita gave about harmony. And something he said, which I thought was very interesting, is that being in harmony doesn't mean necessarily that we have to agree with each other. So we don't have to agree with each other to be in harmony. I thought that was very, very interesting and very important. Because if you think about it, if we needed to agree with each other all the time about everything and share all the same views to be in harmony, well, we're sort of doomed, really, aren't we? Because we all hold such different views about so many different things. And we are quite attached to our views, at least I am, quite attached to our views. So, yeah, if we had to be all agreeing with each other all the time about every little thing, then harmony would be very difficult to achieve. So one of the images that's often used to communicate harmony in a spiritual community is of music being played in an orchestra. So you can imagine you've got this orchestra and they're playing this beautiful symphony, and you've got all the different sections of the musicians. You've got the flautists and the all the different instruments. Drums and violins and all the different ones, and they're all playing their different instruments, and they're all really different, aren't they? There's no way a drum sounds like a flute, no way a flute sounds like a violin. Very, very different, and they're probably all playing different lines, probably all playing different harmonies. They've probably even all got slightly different rhythms to their lines. So there's no way you could say they're doing the same thing there. And what you get is a beautiful, beautiful harmony. So you could say even that the most beautiful harmonies arise when there's difference. So it's like the hands of Avalokiteshvara. So remember I said they're all holding something different to help the world. They're all holding something which is special to them. So it's good to remember this in the spiritual community, especially if we're the sort of person who likes to compare ourselves with other people, that we don't have to be the same. We don't have to be the same. We all have our own talents and our own skills and our own personalities. And when we come together, even if we don't do anything other than coming together, we're helping to build this beautiful community full of different rich and variation. So it's important to remember that difference is okay and doesn't mean you can't have harmony. But then the question that arises is, okay, but then how do we agree? How do we stay in harmony if we disagree with each other? And it's a really important question because often we're going to disagree with each other. I disagree with people many times every day, and I'd like to think that I could still be in harmony with those people. So what is it? So let's go back to the orchestra analogy for a moment to help find out what it is that allows us to still stay in harmony. So you think about all the different instruments, playing the different tunes, etc., as I mentioned. What is it that creates the harmony? Well, it's the fact they're all playing the same piece of music. They've all got different lines in the same piece of music. And it's the vision of the composer that brings those people together, brings the instruments together, harmonizes them, unifies all those different sounds, those different strands, and creates that beauty and brings them into relationship with each other. And I think it's the same in harmony, in other sorts of harmony as well, just the same as with the orchestra. I think we can be in harmony with each other because there's an overall principle which unifies us. And I think the clue to this is with the central hands that Avalokiteshvara has here, and that he's holding the Chintamani, which, remember, is the jewel which fulfills all wishes. It's the transcendental, the wish for the transcendental, that for enlightenment, for the sake of ourselves and all beings. So I think that in our community, it's the transcendental that unifies us, actually. And if that word doesn't do very much for you, you could think of it like this. You could think that what unifies us is a common shared vision of the possibility of continued growth for happiness for ourselves and other people, as expressed by the Buddha. And then that vision as lived out and practiced by way of the Dharma, and then as taught and lived out by our friends in the Sangha. So it's that vision of the three jewels. So the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which is precious and dear to us all, else we wouldn't be here. And it's these three jewels and a commitment to living by it that unites us, just like that piece of music. It gives us a common vision and a common goal. It reminded me a little bit of the thing, that phrase, singing from the same hymn sheet. And I know that's the wrong religion, but I thought it was quite relevant to this. So I think we'll be in harmony as long as we relate to each other from this vision on what's highest. So what Sangharakshita puts it, if we relate to what is deepest or highest in the other person. So it's really easy, isn't it, to relate to somebody on a superficial level. So if I'm having a disagreement with somebody, I tend to relate to them on the level of the disagreement that we're having. Well, no, I don't think we should put the chairs there. I think we should put them over there. And then I easily slip into polarization with that person. And that will lead to disharmony, instantly lead to disharmony. For example, in the community, we have to make all sorts of practical decisions about things. And we sometimes have to decide how we're going to decorate things, which is always a big, lots of views, lots of different opinions in discussions like that. And if somebody asks me what colour I might want a wall painted, for example, I'm going to have an opinion about it, definitely. So will somebody else, and it's going to be different from mine. Very easy then to get into a polarised position where I'm right, they're wrong, here are all the reasons that they're wrong and I'm right, and get lots of righteous indignation going on. Really, really unhelpful if you want to live in harmony with people. So what do I need to do then to stay in harmony with my friends in that situation? Turning my page for a start. So consider so we disagree on this particular topic, but actually what's the bigger picture here? What do we actually, how are we in harmony? We're not in harmony about that particular issue, but there is a harmony that exists between us. And that harmony exists between us because we both relate to the vision of the community, which is to exemplify Sangha and to live according to the Dharma and to become enlightened like the Buddha. That's what brings us together as a community, and that's how we're in harmony. So it's almost like listening beyond my own little line to the beautiful huge music that's going on beyond my own little flute line, to the huge symphony that's happening, and sort of tuning in to the harmony that exists beyond my own view. It means I have to, it means I have to listen, actually. I have to listen beyond that level of disagreement to something which is more beautiful behind it. And I don't know much about playing in orchestras, I must say, but I do know quite a lot about singing with other people. And if anyone here has ever been involved in any singing groups that I've led, because I used to lead the choir here, you'll know that what I always bang on about is listening to each other. I always say the most important thing about singing is listening, because if we're listening, then we can start to be in harmony. If we're not listening to somebody else, there's no chance that we can possibly sing in harmony with them. And I think it's the same for all sorts of harmony. And what this creates really is true communication, what Sangha Rashta calls a vital mutual responsiveness. We're resonating with each other. We're resonating with what's highest and deepest in each other. And we're tuning into the greater vision that we share, both as human beings, actually, who want to be free of suffering, and also as fellow Dharma farers on this path together. And we can also become receptive, if we listen even, to the transcendental, to the whisper of the bodhicitta, the whisper of whatever it is that draws us on to enlightenment, and that thing that we might be aware of sometimes when we're meditating, or when we're in a discussion group, or when we hear something in the Dharma that sparks us and makes us think, oh yeah, that's it. We can really listen to that. So then the Buddha asks, how do they live like this? So we've heard what the practices are, but how does that look? What does that look like in practice? So this is what they say. This is what happens in their community. So they say, Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever one of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery, or drops it into the water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty, he takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech, but every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. So I thought it's a really lovely image of a community living together. And it shows how the beautiful harmony which has been created by the insight that they share is expressed in very simple and ordinary ways. They take care of each other. They take care of the community that they live in and the environment that the community lives in. And they all work together as different hands in the same body, just like the image of Avalokiteshvara. And it was like that when they greeted the Buddha in the beginning. One of them set out the seat, one of them got the water. It was like they were just moving as one being, as one body, in complete and perfect harmony together. And one of the things I really love about this image as well is the attention to detail. They really notice what needs doing around the place, and then they just get on and do it without any fuss. And I was reflecting about this, that this shows how awareness underlines acts of metta. We need awareness if we're going to be metaful. And I was thinking that this seems to be reflected in Avalokiteshvara, in the image of Avalokiteshvara, firstly in his hands. So his hands all have eyes, so he can really see what needs to be done, like what's really needed. Like he sees it, the first thing is that he has to notice it. And also his name, the Lord who looks down, the one who sees. So it's very important that seeing, that awareness. And I actually rejoice in my friend Vicky, who's very, very good at this. I live in the community with her. She often notices what needs doing. And a particular example of this was a few weeks ago when I'd been helping to lead the introductory course, and it was very late, and I was feeling very tired and not very well. And she knew I wasn't feeling very well, and I got home quite late after 11 o'clock, and I went up to my room, and she'd put on my heater and filled up my hot water bottle for me, because my room's very cold. And I could have cried. It was such a lovely thing to do, because it was exactly what was needed at that time. It was exactly what I needed. So I felt very touched and very taken care of and very seen, actually. And I think I was reflecting that even just really noticing and seeing somebody in itself is an act of metta, even if you don't then go on to do anything else. And quite undervalued, actually. So we might sometimes reflect, if we think that we're not metaful enough, if we think we could be do with being a bit more metaful in our behaviour, we could maybe reflect on whether or not we need to begin by being a little bit more aware of ourselves and aware of other people and what's going on around us. And we could also reflect, having heard this description of the Aniruddhas in their community, if there's any practical expressions of harmony that we think we could manifest, maybe in this community. And I thought I would write my own little version of his description, maybe for Sheffield Buddhist Centre. So it might run something like this. So whoever arrives first for Baked Potato Club gets the plates out and the knives and forks out and takes the tops off the pots of hummus. Whoever arrives last eats any food left over if they wish. Otherwise, they put it into Tupperwares or in the compost bin. They help wash the pots and empty the dishwasher and sweep up any crumbs on the floor. Whoever notices that the teapots need filling for the tea break fills them with water. But if they are too heavy for them, they just ask somebody to help them and they move it by joining hands. And each week we come together and spend our evening hearing, discussing and practicing the Dharma together. So I know that's a bit of fun, but actually, hopefully it evokes that the harmony that they have is expressed in these little ways, and we have the opportunity to express it in these little ways every time we're here, in lots and lots of different ways. We can work together to become the hands of Avalokiteshvara and express the love that we feel for each other and also the love that we have for what it is that we build here together for the community. And that we do that with the Dharma as our explicit context. So every 5 days, the Aniruddhas meet and talk about the Dharma. So it's not just that we're being nice to each other. We're trying to develop insight into the nature of reality. We're doing it because of the Dharma. So it's the same thing. It's this part of the same project. So just to conclude, there are 5 points that I think this story tells us about harmony, which I've tried to draw out. So just run through these 5 points. To end. Apologies for this, it turned out that there was half a bit of flip chart paper missing, but hopefully you can still read it. So firstly, harmony is beautiful. It's beautiful, it's not just about getting along and that being the end of it. It involves moving towards deeper and deeper response of metta for other people, and that is beautiful. Secondly, harmony is a practice. It doesn't just happen automatically, it doesn't manifest out of thin air. We have to work at it, and we have to work at it by working on how we act, by how we speak, and how we think. It's not about being the same, not just about being the same. We can be different, we can disagree, and that doesn't mean we can't stay in harmony. And the reason that we can still stay in harmony is because of number 4. Harmony is about mutual self-transcendence. It's about seeing beyond our superficial differences to what it is that truly unites us, to the bigger and more beautiful principle behind it, to the music that exists behind this orchestra of Sangha, not just our own little part. And finally, harmony is expressed in simple acts of care. We can notice what needs to be done and we can act to make it happen. And by doing that, we can really behave like arms of Avalokiteshvara, manifesting the ultimate wish for humanity, the wish to enlightenment and to be liberated forever.